According to the Pew Trust Foundation poll, 4 out of 10 Americans believe that the Second Coming will occur before the year 2050. 4 out of 10 people in our country believe that Jesus Christ will return to earth and it will happen within 40 years. I wonder how many of them believe the rest of the predictions of this scenario, as the most conservative Christians interpret the book of Revelations. I wonder if they also believe that when this happens, the Lord will gather up his faithful followers and take them to heaven, leaving the rest of the world to languish in eternal torment. Do they believe that there is or will be an Antichrist who will require people to show their allegiance by taking the mark of the beast, which is the number 666 on the back of the hand or on the forehead? Some versions predict a reign of evil and chaos that will occur before the rapture and will show us that it's coming. Others predict the reign of evil and chaos will take place after the rapture as a sign that it has happened. Either way, it's a pretty amazing story. I once believed this story. It was taught to me as a young teenager. I was part of the born-again movement of the early 1970s. I was saved, and I was given a fairly strict set of criteria as to what that required, which included a belief in the rapture. However, a major perk of being saved was that I would get raptured, which means to be taken up to heaven en masse when the moment came. But you didn't know that rapture was a verb, too. When I was in the thick of this belief, it did give me a strange kind of comfort, even as it frightened, pardon the expression, the bejesus out of me. The rapture takes the perverse and you might think nonsensical approach of providing hope and meaning by means of fear. And it worked. Our youth group was shown a film that was meant to warn and instruct us, entitled, You've Been Left Behind. We were shown this film more than once, and it frightened me for years, even after I left the fold and no longer rationally believed in any of this stuff. It stayed with me. This meant that I would awaken in the middle of the night, terrified, looking at the foreboding shapes around me and wondering if Jesus had come and I was no longer saved. And I mean for years. In our youth group, we were told this story by adults that we loved and trusted. They and many people still believe in it wholeheartedly. The Left Behind series of books and films still sells in the millions. In a poll taken in New Jersey by a public policy polling firm, when asked if Barack Obama was the Antichrist, 8% of the people polled said yes. 13% said that they weren't sure. Well, that's an interesting response, isn't it? You know, I'm still worth thinking about that one. Could you let me get back to you? So, add these together, and you have 21% who think that he is the Antichrist or could be the Antichrist. So you have to wonder why the pollsters thought this was an important data point to capture. But the response is still remarkable. There are websites that track prophecies to current events, such as raptureready.com. Bill Moyers points out that people who believe in the rapture make up a significant voting bloc. Members of my family, which include Pentecostals, Jehovah's Witnesses, also believe different versions of this story. Intelligent, educated people. Why, do you suppose? Well, the world is a pretty frightening place. The evidence of global warming is becoming overwhelming, with temperatures rising, glaciers melting, island villages disappearing, hurricanes becoming more and more destructive. The economy is not recovering, either as fast as it ought to be or at all, depending on who you talk to. The news is abysmal regarding foreclosure rates and jobless rates. There's terrorism with no neat national borders of where a country is. And nothing contains the enemy. They are simply everywhere. Add in politically driven violence, such as the recent shooting in Tucson of the Representative Gabrielle Giffords and 8 others, and it's pretty overwhelming. It's It's a lot to carry around inside. So given this, I would say that a cosmic story of a battle between good and evil with a rescue by a powerful God makes complete and utter sense. At least emotionally. It's right on par with that level of fear. If you can put what's happening into predicted patterns and give it a religious meaning, and if you can offer instructions on how to be part of the winning side, well, believe this, reject that, live as the Bible says you should, or your interpretation of that, then it would help you cope. Karen Armstrong says that the grip this story has within America, particularly the projection of the Antichrist onto a real person, our president, is a sign of an unhappy society. And I would say a fearful one. The rapture is, I would argue, one strain of Christianity's attempt to deal with the daily fears we experience in the world. Thus, stories about messiahs. I'm reminded of a scene from a documentary called Waiting for Superman. This film tells the story of the Harlem Children's Zone, or HCZ, which is a strategic effort in New York to radically change education in one neighborhood. Its director, Jeffrey Canada, opens the film describing a moment from his childhood growing up in Harlem. He says, "The saddest days of my life was when my mother told me that Superman did not exist. I read comic books and I just loved them, you know? Because even in the depths of the ghetto, you just thought, he's coming. I just don't know when, because he always shows up and saves the good people." Then when he was in the fourth or fifth grade, he asked, "Ma, do you think Superman is actually real?" And she told him the truth. Superman is not real. I was like, "He's not? What do you mean he's not?" "No, he's not real." And she thought, he said, she thought because I was crying because it was like Santa Claus is not real. And I was crying because there was no one coming with enough power to save us. The rapture is such a strange idea. It's easy to make fun of. Praying for Superman to show up is a sad idea. And it's easy to feel bad for a child who felt that Superman was his best hope. And both ideas become immediately more understandable when you consider how afraid we can all be, all of us, how susceptible we are to this longing for a rescue. A big swath of American voters did the same thing a few years ago. You may or may not have voted for Barack Obama, but many who did were swept up in the notion that he was going to save our country. And while progressive voters probably wouldn't agree that Obama is the Antichrist, they are counted among the most critical of the president. Good people are still hurting. The Messiah did not come. But as the Baal Shem Tov would say, you are here, and that is good. And you can save us. A rabbi friend of mine insists that there have always been Jews who have located the Messiah not in a single human being, but among all the people caring for the world. That is their source of hope. And as Unitarian Universalists, it's always been ours. The spirit of life, or as some would say, God, needs to work through us to save the world. There is a Messiah, lots of us. Jeffrey Canada, the founder and director of the Harlem Children's Zone, is a good example. His work is about what happens when you give up waiting for Superman. It's what happens when you love children and put them first. It's a kind of quiet heroism, as Tom Friedman put it, of all the people doing what they know works, with patience, love, and tenacity. So lots of messiahs, and I think we know this. The problem is that we get a little weary. Rebecca Parker points out that the social gospel, which argues that we must work to create God's kingdom on earth, is exhausting. For we are never really there, it never really arrives. We focus on our ideals, she says, which are always tantalizing at a distance. Ideals do not administer spiritual assistance to us, she writes. They do not come to the kitchen table in the night of fear. Ideals do not surround the soul with comfort or refreshment or renew the heart's courage. Ideals would not have helped me as a teenager or even as a freshman in college, still waking up, still afraid of the rapture. Focusing on ideals is thin gruel, like a gruff jab to the shoulder and being urged to buck up. They are part of the world of someday and not now, the world of not enough. And we live so much of the time in a state of not enough. Walter Brueggemann calls this anxious scarcity. We want more. We want it now, but it's not here yet. What Rebecca Parker called for in our reading this morning was for us to cultivate a sense of abundance in the here and now, a reverence for the garden. So if our first answer to fear is lots of messiahs, the second answer is to be here now. Thus, we borrow from Eastern traditions, but also the part of Christianity that always has said, the kingdom is within you, the kingdom is among you, always and already, now. We need to be fully present to engage it. And we are not, friends. Our attention is becoming more and more and more fragmented. We have more and more streams of data, incoming information and communication. I once heard an interview on Fresh Air with Matt Richtel, a technology reporter for the New York Times. He calculates that we now consume 3 times the amount of information in a day than we used to in 1960 in a matter of weeks. So we get so much of it so fast that we no longer have time to process anything we take in. We become worse at filtering out irrelevant information, and we can lose our capacity to focus on one thing at a time. This summer, my husband, Robert, and I were invited to Longwood Gardens with some friends of ours. If you ever visit my town in Wilmington, Delaware, the very first place you need to go is Longwood Gardens. It's very beautiful. A generous legacy gift from the DuPont dynasty. And they are some of the most grand, exquisite public gardens anywhere. So Robert and I were given a deep discount on one of their fireworks and fountains shows, this one featuring music of the Beatles. Someone in our group who works at Longwood went in early and tied sheets around a few benches with some bungee cords. These were some fabulous seats. They looked down on a great expanse of the grounds, now filled with 3,000 people. And as it was getting darker, I noticed something interesting. Distributed among this sea of people was a smaller sea of small glowing squares. About every 20th person, it appeared, was holding an iPhone, a BlackBerry, an iPad, a Droid, or some other such device. They were stroking it, jabbing it, or gazing expectantly at it. And yeah, at first I thought, well, you know, people are just kind of restless, the show was starting late. But even when it started, most of the squares stayed lit. They were lit up the whole time. Jean-Paul Sartre once wrote that hell was the place where the lights were on all the time. Hell is a state of hypervigilance that never allows us to rest. Here we were in some of the most magnificent gardens in the world, paradise by anyone's standards. We were surrounded by beauty and beloved music, and a good chunk of us simply couldn't let go, couldn't give ourselves over to it. I imagined someone texting this experience to a friend, like, OMG, I'm in awe. And I would have replied, you are not in awe. You are texting. Send. dividing ourselves, starves our capacity for awe. We lose our ability to fully connect to our immediate world. If we love what we pay attention to, you could argue, This division of our attention starves our capacity for love. It feeds our restless desire for more. And an insatiable desire for more, argues Rebecca Parker, is what got us into trouble in the first place. If we are to be here now, we must find ways to rest, to be present in the garden, the lovely garden that is here now. We must give our minds time to process things a little more slowly. We must love this garden well enough to care for it. And there's a third thing. We also need to connect somehow to something larger than ourselves, however you conceive of it, the web of all existence or God or your community, but something larger than yourself. We tend to live very separate, unconnected lives. We like to think that we're in control, that we are somehow the gods of our own little universes. There's a biography of the AA founder, Bill W., that is called Not God. Not God is one of the founding ideas of his when he started AA. Now, before all the atheists get real excited, let me explain what this means. Alcoholics, he says, tend to think that they are in control of every aspect of their lives, that they are, in fact, God. So much of our lives are not in our control. And to avoid facing this, there are many, many appealing substances to help us not do this. The beginning of recovery from drinking or any other addiction, and I would say the beginning of any honest spiritual life, is to first admit that you are not God. Addicts are then urged to find a higher power on which to rely. And I find that whenever I'm fearful, it's always, always helpful for me to ask what my higher power is today. That is, what do I consider my means of survival, the source of life in my life? If it's my job, if it's success, if it's another person, even or especially if it is my own ego, I am thinking way too small. The gods we tend to lean on usually are too small. They fail us regularly. Marriages end, jobs vanish, loved ones die. And when they do, life as we know it ends. We're afraid nothing will come after it, and yet we are held up somehow. We are held up. This flowing, mysterious source of love just doesn't stop. Every one of us in this room, I'm willing to bet, could tell a story of coming back after thinking that all was lost. And every one of us could name someone who held us up during this time. They might be in this very room. We just need one person to love us, to really understand this idea of a bigger kind of love. One person. So let me tell you what I would do when I would wake up afraid in the middle of the night, terrified that the rapture had come. I kept a telephone number by my bedside. It was a number of a place, a hotline called Love Lines, which might sound a little suggestive to you, especially for a phone call at 3 a.m. But Love Lines were a 24-hour helpline run by born-again Christians. So this was my teenage, formerly saved logic. If I call this number and a real Christian answers, then the rapture hasn't come. I'm not defending my thinking here, I'm just reporting. So I would wake up a sleepy volunteer who was working the phones that night. Sometimes I would just hang up before, right when I heard the voice. But sometimes I'd talk to the person, and he or she would come out of their sleepy fog and try to understand what this weird agnostic was trying to tell them. But I no longer believed in any of that stuff, but I was still afraid. Some volunteers really never got it. Some got angry, some tried to save me. That would make sense, wouldn't it? But every once in a while, one of them just got it. That her job in that moment was to be the unconditional love of God to a lost teenager. And in that way, I was saved. What our Unitarian Universalist faith offers is the chance to be the person on the other line, on the end of the other line, always and forever, for each of us to be not God, but bearers of the love of God, whatever you call it. That is what we do in response to fear. We are that voice on the other end of the phone for someone else, whether we fully understand them or not. We trust that someone will be there for us. We have to remember that there is simply more to